Now, some members of our study group will present their reflections. First, we'll hear from Joanna Prendeville.
Good morning. Bring it down?
Yes.
Thank you. As an immigrant, I have an advantage over most of you. I can stand back and look at this country long and hard. I can look at its geography, its history, its people in a different light. I can see what their people are like, what they look like, how they speak, what they think, and I can get away with that. I love this place we call the land of the free and the home of the brave. Even if I have to be reminded from time to time that I am critical of it and the way we do things. But see, I can do that too because America guarantees me freedom of speech. That's a very nice thing. I think of this country much the way I think about my family. You know, it's not perfect, but it's mine. And I wouldn't trade it for a magic wand. No way. The topic for today's consideration, as Amanda and Gil has told you, is white fragility. And that's a fairly new term to me. It may be new to some of you. What does it mean? It means that whether we realize it or not, we white Americans are privileged when compared with people we consider non-white. White fragility is about racism, plain and simple. When I started reading this book, I thought, that's interesting. But a little voice inside my head said, yeah, interesting, maybe, but it really doesn't pertain to you. Why? Because I'm not a racist. Plain and simple, I'm not a racist. However, after I finished reading the book and having listened to my colleagues, I had to admit that I was wrong about that. It does pertain to me and to you and to everyone who is white and privileged in America. I really had never thought of myself as being privileged, but the fact is, I am, and I have been since the day I arrived. So, when and how did all this happen? Let's start with the word race. R-A-C-E. Race is a social construct created by white Europeans to distinguish themselves from people they believe to be inferior. It justified a lot of what they did during their period of conquest, or what we call colonialism. And we know about colonialism, the way it imposes its power on people, conquers them, and the destruction it leaves behind. That's evident. Didn't we fight the Revolutionary War just to get rid of colonialism? Well, like it or not, we are the stepchild of our European ancestors. And as such, we have inherited some of their practices. One of them is the right to trial by jury. Good. Another one is racism. Not so good. In the 1600s, English settlers on the Plymouth Plantation declared that their colony would be white and Protestant. Oh, they brought along some Irish indentured servants, that's true, who were Catholic, but they were not allowed to practice their religion. And they were relegated to sleep with the animals. The Irish were said to be a separate, meaning inferior, race of people. We, as citizens of the United States, have supported our government's racist policies ever since. Literally millions of Native Americans died defending their homeland, their families, their way of life. This is no secret. Survivors were forced onto reservation land that was really unfit to sustain life. After a series of long and devastating wars, they were conquered. And here's an interesting statistic. Our government signed and subsequently broke treaties with Native Americans. How many? 378 broken treaties. In 1848, Congress declared they debated not how much land the U.S. would take from Mexico at the end of the Mexican-American War, but the number of people who lived on that land. That was a problem because those people were considered non-white, and they might undermine the notion that this was a white Protestant country. Congress passed the Chinese exclusion laws in 1880s, and that said something about how our government felt about Asian immigrants. The Japanese internment camps were built in the 1940s. Likewise, we know African Americans were enslaved along with their children. Thomas Jefferson, one of our founding fathers, refused to free his slaves before he died, even though some of them were his own sons and daughters. So yes, it seems we have a long history of racism in this country, but we're still young. Only 200 years, still learning. We passed the Emancipation Proclamation in 1865. Slaves were made free. Ah, but in the small print it says they were not given the right to citizenship. They were just free. It took 99 years for Congress to pass the Civil Rights Bill, and another year before they passed the Voting Rights Bill. So 100 years before the people who were free to vote. Then we elected a mixed-race president in 2008. That was impressive. But does that mean equality? Ask someone who lives on an Indian reservation in a Hispanic barrio, a tenement in a black ghetto, or a crowded Chinatown. They'll tell you, we live in a racist society. Racism is the norm, and this racism is fueled by power. It's the kind of power that comes with wealth. Wealth and privilege are synonymous. In our country, the lion's share of the nation's wealth is in the hands of white people. So if you're white, you have greater options in terms of schooling, career advancement, lifestyle, financial security, even recreational opportunities. If you are white, you can earn more money. The more money you make, the whiter your world will be. I'm surprised to learn that I'm part of this system. I may not be at the top of the heap, but I'm in the system. And so are you. We're all a part of it. What can we do to change that? We can do a lot. We can do some of the things Amanda recommended. We can become more aware of the social and political inequities that exist in our society. We can become more sensitive to the ways in which it affects others and see if we can soften those. You can listen to what's happening. Speak for justice. If nothing else, phone your elected representative and hold them accountable. Darn it. They said they were going to represent all their constituents. See to it that they do that. I'm going to close now. The Constitution says all men are created equal. They mean all men and women. I have my doubts about that, but you'll forgive me, Jane. But we're 200 years old, you know, and it's time we started to grow up. I think that being created equal is not enough, that that should be extended through childhood equality and then through adulthood and even farther. I don't think that as Americans we will have arrived until we make equal rights part of our proud American human rights policy. Okay.
Next, we'll hear the words of Kitty Donich, delivered by Carolyn Boyd.
James Baldwin said, "Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced." White fragility, straightforward to define, difficult to embrace. I had read Robin DiAngelo's book, White Fragility, before we started this discussion group. I thought it would be interesting to talk it over with others, but I believed I'd already gotten her point. DiAngelo writes vividly, and I felt her frustration at the stubbornness and blindness of some participants in her anti-racist workshops. I rolled my eyes and ground my teeth reading about them. But my own conviction that I was not racist was so ingrained I didn't even see that she wasn't simply writing about a bunch of other mule-headed white people. She was writing about me. We all started the group this way, defensive and in denial. We couldn't be racist. Among the 10 of us that first day, one or the other of us, as you just heard, came up with almost every statement DiAngelo lists that she's heard over the years to excuse individual racism. So no, she didn't mean us. We missed the point. DiAngelo's book is not about cruel and discriminatory acts of a single individual aimed at another individual or group. DiAngelo's message is that no matter our personal feelings, we cannot avoid racism because our society is structurally and institutionally racist. Our country, our government, our economy are controlled by white people for our benefit. We live in white neighborhoods, our children go to white schools, most of the doctors and teachers and lawyers and grocery store clerks we meet are white. None of the problems I have had to deal with in my life, buying a house, finding decent medical care, going grocery shopping, being pulled over for speeding, has been made more difficult or even dangerous because of my skin color. I have glided through life accepting unearned privilege based on my whiteness. It is so ordinary and all-encompassing, I didn't even see it. I am deeply ashamed by this blindness. But DiAngelo's further message is that we, do not need to take on guilt for establishing this racist power structure. I was born into it, as we all were. Taking on that much guilt is overwhelming. It creates resistance, which prevents action. My life has been made easier and more comfortable because I was born white. My children are safer. That makes me lucky, not evil. But though I didn't create the racist policies we live under, I must stop turning a blind eye. It's time for me to look for and acknowledge my racist words and behaviors when I recognize them. They are so unintentional, it takes vigilance to catch them. It's also time I, and all of us, stop overlooking such behaviors in others. Racist words and actions are unjust, often illegal, and inflict pain on our fellow citizens of color. My silence resounds as acceptance of white privilege, and okay to policies I claim to oppose. We can't move forward burdened by guilt and denial, but neither will we accomplish anything if we continue keeping our eyes averted, pretending all this applies to someone else, and handing the problem on to the next generation unchanged as it was handed to us. The obstacles to creating a fully egalitarian society are huge. We won't achieve one in our lifetimes, nor in our children's, and probably not in our grandchildren's. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't begin. I don't want my grandchildren to be able to look back at my life and say, "Couldn't you have done something, Grandma?" Thank you, Kitty.
Well, not so long ago, I was speaking to a friend about my experience about being an American in Honduras last spring. My friend quite rightly pointed out that many Hondurans consider themselves to be American also. She reminded me that the U.S. is one of many countries in the Americas, and that people of Central and South America are often perplexed when U.S. citizens think they are the only Americans in the world. Well, I blurted out an uncomfortable, "I knew that," and I pushed the conversation back to the point that I had been trying to make. Well, what had happened in that moment? I had been corrected and immediately felt defensive. I had heard of this issue in the past, but had never put it front and center for myself. To be called out on it prompted that red-faced shame that I remember from being a small child in a classroom, raising my hand, being called on, and eagerly delivering the wrong answer. For me, this response reflected my white fragility. Now you, and maybe even you, might say to me, "Well, Ida, that's not so bad. That's not a racist comment. Give yourself a break. You can't be perfect all the time." Well, thank you, but that's not the point. My comment, despite knowing better, was an illustration of what living a privileged life in a dominant culture can produce: the ability to ignore the experience of others who are being oppressed. There is a long and painful history of European and USA colonization in the Americas. Our country has supported wars, overturned governments, and actively backed brutal dictators, actions which extend to this day. When I use language implying that U.S. citizens are the only true Americans, that synchronizes with the power the USA and its corporations have exerted over many countries in the Americas. Even knowing all of this, I can still easily stumble into a microaggression as I did that day. The more I learn about racial issues, the more I come up against my assumptions and small behaviors which reflect and reinforce the white dominance of the culture that I live in and thrive in. That can be painful for me as well as others. I find I need to continually acknowledge and then set aside these feelings, which go with my white fragility, so I can continue with this journey. What helps me in this task? I'm finding that nurturing my curiosity and my humility is the key. Curiosity allows me to keep an open heart to learning new perspectives. It creates an excitement to learning more, and I find that this balances the discomfort which comes with much of this information. Curiosity prompts me to seek out, listen, and believe stories from people of color and historically marginalized peoples to try to understand the complexities of racial issues. Humility allows me to hear these stories. It leaves me free to not have to be perfect, to not have to be defensive, and to hear what I might do differently, even if it's just using a different word. Humility helps me to understand that even if I mean well, my words may hurt others, and my words can help to reinforce rigid, racial stereotypes and attitudes. When I practice humility, I can say thank you when somebody corrects me. And I find that this simple act is good for my heart. Curiosity and humility applied to my daily life. That is my spiritual practice.